afternoon and welcome to episode 50 of the Deck Tease Podcast, brought to you by LegitMTG.com. My name is Erin Campbell. Episode 50 is a big deal, you guys. This is the season 6 premiere of my show. I've also been doing this for a year as of the month of July. And like I've done on other season premieres, I knew that I had to bring it. I knew that I had to get somebody good. And last season premiere, I had Mr. Brian Kibler on the show. And I realized I kind of painted myself in a corner because who's bigger than Kibler? Like, what? I mean, he's cute. He's good at the game. He's got the dog. I mean, what am I going to do? How am I ever going to top Kibler? Oh, yeah. John Finkel. How's it going, John Finkel?
I'm doing pretty well. How you doing, Erin?
I am doing great. Trying to keep cool. Hot outside.
Yeah, it's pretty rough here in New York as well.
Ugh. Well, at least we are here in the air conditioning together.
Yep. Well, in different places, but at least I'm in air conditioning.
That's true. Mine kind of comes and goes. So it's...
Yeah, mine could be better, but that's just because I live in like a converted loft building that was initially built to be a factory of some sort. So, you know, the insulation is probably not the best.
Gotcha. Well, this is super, and this is super huge. I mean, you are the biggest guest I've ever had on, and I really appreciate you coming on my show to celebrate these milestones with me. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, and congratulations on making it through 50 episodes in a year.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a crazy wild ride, to be quite honest. I think I have to pinch myself as I talk to you. Like, he's here. This is really happening.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So let's just go ahead and get started right away. When I was doing some research on you, because I do research on all of my guests, I did find a tidbit where Mark Rosewater himself has gone on record as saying that you are the most naturally gifted player that the game has ever seen. What does it feel like to hear that from someone like him?
It's nice. I guess the flip side is also that I'm lazy, which would also be fair. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, it's gratifying to hear things like that. You know, I don't really know what actually makes one gifted at Magic, but whatever sort of random traits it is, you know, they are, I guess I have it.
Mm-hmm. And that was actually my other question for you is that, you know, whether or not people like to admit it, there are a lot of things in the game that do come down to luck. You can be mana screwed, you can get mana flooded, your opponent can draw a miracle bonfire. All of those things can happen and really determine the outcome of the game for you. You know, so the word gifted, like, what do you think that might mean when somebody says that about you or anybody else?
So I don't actually think that the variance within Magic really plays into this answer here.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, at some level, right, being gifted, or let's just say being good at Magic, whether it's because you're gifted or because you've worked really hard at it, it's just about getting, you know, your probabilities up as high as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a ton of, you know, volatility in shooting a basketball or going up a bat, you know, and someone, you know, who, like Barry Bonds, you know, had one of the best seasons of all time. You know, maybe he hits 370, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, maybe has like a 500 on base percentage. I probably chose something that's a little bit too good. But let's say, you know, you have someone who hits 320 a season for his career. You know, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. You know, you have someone who hits 280 for their career, maybe make the All-Star game once. And, you know, there's obviously a big difference in the gifts between them just because – the fact of the matter is that most of the time when you're swinging a bat at a baseball, it's going to come down to luck. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's, you know, pretty apt analogy in Magic. You know, the difference between being, you know, the current best on the Pro Tour, you know, and somebody who's just pretty solid is, you know, maybe one guy is like a 64, 65% expected win percentage that season and the other guy is 60 and, you know, the average is 50. I mean, you know, so whatever LSV 3 years ago versus, you know, Kibler 3 years ago or whatever, you know, what's the difference? You know, 5% expected win percentage, you know, 1 in 20 matches, maybe LSV wins. I don't know. Those may, we weren't the best examples. I don't really know who was, you know, I don't know if LSV was the best, you know, 3 years ago. And if Kibler was somebody, I guess I used him because you just mentioned him earlier,
sure,
who was also a phenomenal Magic player, but, you know, not the best, you know, it's, you know, so I mean, being good at it is just, you know, getting your percentages up as high as possible and then, you know, hoping for, you know, the rest to work out.
That was actually something I was really surprised about. I came back to the game around the time of Innistrad, and I immediately set out to be good at the game. And I'm doing like the finger quotation marks with good. And it was funny because I would really beat myself up when I would not do well. And people would say to me, you know, you do realize that Finkel's overall win percentage is, you know, 60% of the time, or Kibler's is 55% of the time. And I think there's this misconception when they see people like you, John, or they see pros doing well, that you guys don't lose. They just assume that, you know, you have these strings of wins, and to lose is foreign to you. And I didn't realize that. And when you hear things like that, like your overall win percentage is only 60%, it does make the goal of being good, again with the quotation marks, it does make it sound more realistic. And like it's not so, and like you're not so different from the rest of us. Not that that's a bad thing, but you know, it just sounds more attainable. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, obviously for every, you know, winner, there has to be a loser. You know, sure. It's whatever what was that short story, you know, the town where everybody's above average, mm-hmm. You know, which obviously can't exist. So I do believe my lifetime win percentage in the Pro Tour is actually about 65%.
Okay.
Kibler's was about 59 or 60. I got some of these numbers were going around like a year ago or so, mm-hmm. You know, and all right, you know, I played some years where maybe I wasn't really – I mean, I played a number of tournaments where I wasn't trying as hard, where I wasn't really involved in the game. So, you know, it was maybe at my absolute best, you know, I could have expected to win 70% of matches, you know, in a season. Like, maybe, you know. So, I mean, but, you know, if you figure out – even if you're expected to win 70% of matches going into a tournament, you're still not a favorite to make the top eight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I worked out the math a couple times. You know, and I think in an article I wrote, and you know, yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of thing where it's the differences are small, but they're hard to get at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go to the Olympics, you know, and you go to like, you know, the people that are running, you know, that are running like 100, you know, meter dashes.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I just thought like Usain Bolt came and like kind of blew some things out. But even there, like the difference between, you know, the best and the second best and the previous best, we're talking like, you know, hundredths of seconds, you know, a second on a race that takes about 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the differences are very small, but improving, you know, when you're close to, you know, the best you can be, improving your time by a few hundredths of a second is probably about as hard as it was to, you know, get the first few seconds off your time, you know, back when you started.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and, you know, I can even see it myself, you know, the differences between, you know, when I was, you know, really engaged and, you know, was at my absolute best versus the time when maybe I was paying some attention, but not, you know, it's maybe a few percent here or there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, like I had a pretty good season in 2002 when I really wasn't doing very much at all. I mean, I did well in like all the draft pro tours, and they had two that year. And maybe I randomly did well in constructive pro tour. Whereas a year like, you know, 1997, I was, you know, way more engaged, probably better. 99 as well, you know, but you know, that's just variance. So, you know, maybe in 2002, I was supposed to be a 60, you know, 3% winner. And the other year I was supposed to be a 67% winner, but you know, it just played out that I did better in that other year.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, though, there is a lot of, you know, randomness at work, a lot of variance at work. Like you said, that there are a lot of things that you can do to sort of, you know, turn the tide or to make it so the variance isn't so, the percentage of variance isn't so high. You know, so maybe like, you know, being gifted is something that you could be taught or it's something you can work on. Would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what someone exactly means when they use the word gifted. Mm-hmm. I mean, being good at magic, you know, there's a lot of things that go into it. And obviously there's some set of natural talents and abilities that have to be relevant, right? There's variation within the population.
Sure.
You know, but there's also, you know, how much time you spend, you know, how focused you are if you're trying to become, you know, quotes, good at magic versus building, you know, the best casual deck because you think it's fun or you want to build, you know, do cool things, you know, how dedicated you are to preparing before tournaments, you know, how good the playtest group is you play with, you know, all of these things, you know, all come into play, you know, when it comes to talking about what it means to be, you know, good at magic.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've admitted at various points throughout your career that you, like you said before, even a couple minutes ago, that sometimes you either lose interest in the game or you get disconnected from the game. What is it that causes those feelings in you, John?
I mean, you know, the first time was in 1998. I just kind of got into poker. Magic, I had a really good year in 1998. I was player of the year. I won a Pro Tour. I don't know. Most of it is just like responding to like a visceral reaction. It's like I just didn't really want to play Magic as much as I wanted to do these other things. So, I could try to backsolve what the reasons are, for my feeling that way. But in reality, it was just that when I woke up in the morning, less often it was like, oh, I want to play Magic. Oh, I want to, build this random constructed deck. I know a part of it at least was that around that time, kind of, they started to like up Grand Prix and the importance of Grand Prix. And, I went to some in the early years, but I knew that I wasn't going to be going to all these Grand Prix. And there's a thing when you kind of competing or looking to try to win a prize, and then you're like, oh, I'm not going to have an ability to win this, that I think makes you a little bit, less inclined to, care as much about it.
Sure.
I knew I wasn't going to go to, a bunch of Grand Prix, and I knew that it would be very hard to win Player of the Year if you didn't. Then I guess in 2000, I decided, okay, I'm going to, yeah, in 99, I still cared. I was like, I still played, but
Sure.
it was also, feeling something like a job,
Well,
in
it
2000.
actually was your job at that point, it sounds like.
Yeah. In 2000, I decided, I was going to at least try again for a few tournaments. Things broke well, at Nationals and Worlds, and I ended up, doing well and going through, and I had a good run right there. But then, by like the end of 2000, again, like my heart wasn't quite in it. Constructed tournaments, so much homework. I never really did my homework. I was, when I was in school anyway.
That's a great message for the kids who want to be, famous pro players. They're going to hear this and be like, Finkel didn't do his homework. I don't either.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible though, to be good at Magic right now without doing your homework.
Right.
And then, I would play and I would go to shop at Pro Tours, but it would mostly just be, getting a deck from someone last minute, or then, they sell all draft Pro Tours. Maybe I'd draft a set some, or I would, have drafted at some of like the previous Pro Tour. I was still going by on some sort of, fumes or whatever, but then, eventually by the end of like 02 or into 03, like I, enough sets have gone by where like I wasn't really paying as much attention as I could. So just time, I started to, 304, like I had, went some Pro Tours, did crappy at them all. And, I was getting busy with other things, and, so I just, stopped going.
You said that part of the reason you were sort of losing interest was the fact that it had felt like a job, and like I said, it was your job at that point. Do you feel like if you weren't so successful, and if the game hadn't become your job, figuratively and literally, that you would have still felt that way? Like if you were still at the up and coming level, like you weren't, John Finkel yet, would you still have been enjoying the game that much, or would you still have probably felt that way just because you've been playing for so long?
I mean, I don't know. It's hard to look back at my, 20, 22-year-old self, in play what if situations. I mean, I think that I just, I believe that if I'd had take me a little bit longer to have success. I mean, it did take me a while, like my first, but is it I probably would have been more engaged for a little bit longer, just because I would have, felt like I had more to prove. And I'm sure that, my next obsession, which I guess at that point was poker, starting when I was 20, would maybe have not taken over quite so much, and replaced it.
It's interesting that you say that because I feel like in the last year or two, there's been a lot of attempts to sort of dispel the myths behind pro players. And, for a while, I do feel like there was this sort of, there was this mysterious allure to being a pro player, and people would look at you guys and think that all you did was jet set and win tournaments and trophies and cash. And, you were living this great lifestyle. And in the last year or so, I feel like a lot of pros have come forward to say, it isn't all fun and games. And sometimes it is a bummer. And sometimes we don't want to be doing this. And, just sort of letting letting people know that you guys aren't much different than we are. And it's very interesting to say that, you know, that there are times where you just didn't want to do it. Because I feel like that's something we don't quite hear very often. You know, anytime you see a pro tweet, they're like, I'm so glad to be here. And I'm sure that there are days where you're not. And I'm really glad that you admitted that. Because I think that's something we don't get to see very often.
Yeah, I mean, although it's also, you know, a bit of poor little rich girl, right? Like, mm-hmm. woe is me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's lots of the people who would love to be in your spot. You know, and I mean, part of it also is, I think, just the nature of, you know, public statements where, you know, people are much more inclined to just share, you know, when, you know, things go well, when they win, when they're happy to be somewhere, rather than being like, oh, I'm kind of bored, or, you know, the week before, oh, I probably should play test it, but I don't really feel like it, mm-hmm. you know.
So when you see things like that, you know, do you feel that that's a smart move for a pro player to do, to sort of let themselves appear more human and more reachable? Or do you think that they should sort of maybe keep that under wraps?
I mean, I'm not sure what you mean. I'm not sure what I would mean by a smart move. I mean, I think that they should do what they want to do. You know, I don't necessarily think I mean, a smart move in terms of what, like along what axis?
Well, I just mean like, you know, like you going back to the poor little rich girl metaphor, you know, like let's say you're following somebody who's also a pro player and you see them kind of, you know, well, I don't want to get up this morning. I really don't want to do this. Or they, you know, they're telling people, you know, how bad they might have it. You know, do you think that they should be keeping up that image of the smiling, happy pro player, or should they be allowed to sort of show the cracks sometimes?
I mean, I feel like there's a kind of like an assumption, which maybe is not even wrong, you know, in your question that, you know, it's like a public persona, something that like they have to keep up, like, you know, like a brand or something, which, I mean, I don't really think about it necessarily so much in those terms. I mean, you know, I definitely, you know, try not to, you know, say anything disparaging in public
sure.
of other people, you know, but, you know, there's this great Onion article, you know, that's headline, it was, you know, I am a brand, pathetic man says. You know, and I don't know, I mean, I don't know, is it a smart move for somebody to, you know, post to tweet or Facebook post when they're happy and not when they're not? Mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, it's probably gonna make them a little bit of a happier person. I mean, it's probably a little bit better for building a brand, you know, but I don't know if those are necessarily the, maybe the happier person should be the sort of thing they should be thinking about. But you know, I also mean the world where every Magic player is like, I'm going to say I'm happy all the time because then people will follow me more and then we might get more sponsorship money or people
sure.
will read my articles. You know, I mean, whatever. Maybe some people are doing that calculus. I don't know.
So, I mean, as far as I can tell, I mean, I have had a couple of other pros on my show and it does seem like, and maybe things have changed, but it does sound like there is more of an emphasis on creating a brand. You know, you've got Roberto Gonzalez who, you know, is selling himself as Mr. Bowtie and wearing the bow ties all of the time. And, you know, you do have, you know, other pros that go out of their way to, you know, market themselves as being streamers and writers and this. And I would actually think that, you know, building a brand is more important now than ever as a pro. That's just me. But
I mean, you know, more important, you know, in terms of what? I mean, if you want to maximize your income for Magic, mm-hmm. You know, yeah, it probably helps. You know, if – so, I mean, I guess in that way it's fine. But, you know, if you're just looking at – if you're mostly looking at Magic, let's say, as a game that you're playing and trying to be competitive in, you know, I don't know if it makes Tim Duncan a better or worse basketball player if he has, like, a brand in public that everyone's like, oh, that's, you know, Tim Duncan's style or whatever, you know. In fact, I mean, if you look at some sports, it seems like, in general, the people that do that, it probably detracts from, you know, from their game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, you know, in Magic, I mean, you know, you're not going to make a ton of money with prize money, so, you know, writing articles, you know, and creating content is, you know, obviously an important part if you're going to make your primary, you know, source of income be Magic, you know. So, you know, I understand it, you know, but, you know, I don't really go through life thinking about what actions or statements are going to, you know, best help to build my brand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm in kind of a lucky spot in that regard, obviously. So, I mean, I don't really know how to answer a question. It's like, is this a smart thing to do? Well, I guess if you want to build a brand, it's probably a smart thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it boils down to is, like you said, you know, and I think that's also more of the realization that these guys are having and realizing that this, you know, the ride that comes with being a pro player is not going to last forever, and that maybe they're not going to make the most money. They realize, you know, they're realizing they're not going to make all this money from being a pro. So they're looking to sort of diversify themselves and saying, well, I can be a pro player, but I don't want that to be my only avenue. I want to be able to write and stream and podcast maybe, or make appearances and just sort of, you know, be known for not just that one thing, because that one thing may not always be there. And that's sort of why I'm seeing a lot more pros work on having a brand, so that they're good at something other than just that. So
yeah, I will say, of all of them, the guy who last week, Brian Kibler, is his brand is actually just who he is too. Like, he's like, you know, so you know, and so I just wanted to say that. Although I think a lot of people know that, you know, he's you know, happy, energetic,
yeah,
you know, talkative, very talkative.
Yeah, he's definitely nice somebody guy. Where I had him on my show, and I'll admit that I admit that for a while I had the misconception that there was a Brian Kibler veneer, and I admit when I had him on my show, I was like, you know, I'm gonna find this different side of him that no one's ever seen before, and he was truly him, 100%, and that he really is that happy to be there, and you know, the facial expressions and the personality, you know, none of that is contrived, you know, and nope. And he does share his life with people, and there's just nothing fake about it, and yeah, he's definitely one of the more realer people I've ever met, and that's fantastic.
And to be honest, I don't want to, like, imply by omission that, you know, I'm saying other things about, like, other Magic players
who
build a brand. Like, I mean, literally, like, you mentioned a guy, Roberto Gonzalez. I have an idea in my head who I think he is, but I'm not even sure.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I'm sorry, Roberto, if you're, you know, maybe I might Google image search him now and make sure, and see if he's it just in general, like, you know, the concept of self-branding, I don't know, has never been my real,
sure,
you know, my real gig.
Maybe he'll send you a bow tie and he'll induct you into the bow tie mafia. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
So with that said, though, you know, do you feel like there's anything left to motivate you to keep playing?
Okay, yeah.
Really feel like you're reaching the point where you've done it all? I know there's been a lot of talk of the Hall of Fame lately, and somebody made a comment on Twitter that getting into the Hall of Fame is more, has a habit of sort of getting people to stop playing. Would you agree with that?
To stop playing?
Yeah, because people feel like maybe they've done it all, or there's nothing left to accomplish, and that's sort of, you know, the top.
I mean, I don't know. I play because I like it. I like the competition. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing, there'll be anything that I, you know, will be as good at in my life as, you know, I was at Magic when I was, you know, 20 years old. You know, it's a good game. It's enjoyable. You know, I like, you know, the people I play with at Star City. I mean, in my case, you know, getting the Hall of Fame kind of got me to play again somewhat. You know, I hadn't played at all for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I didn't play it all during Kamigawa block. I played very little bit of drafting during the I think it was Mirrodin block, the Arcbound Ravager block. And, you know, when I got into the Hall of Fame, they actually sent me, like, I don't know, like a case with, like, one of every set that was in print or whatever. And it was, you know,
really?
Like Kamigawa block, Ravnica. I don't know if the second pack was out. Second set was out. Maybe it was two boxes of Ravnica, maybe like the M or whatever. And, you know, I was like, all right, you know, let me get together some people I knew from Magic, used to play you know, from New York, used to play Magic and draft it. And it was fun. I was like, all right, yeah, let's draft. And it was a lot more fun since, you know, it wasn't, you know, always about maximizing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I want to dwell on that for a bit. So you weren't playing for a while and people just magically sent you cards to get you to play again?
No, it was when I got inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Oh, okay. I thought that was a perk.
Sent to me as like a gift or whatever.
Okay. See, I thought, you know, that was all you had to do being John Finkel, where you could just be like, I'm not playing this block, and then all of a sudden someone sends you a box, like
No. You know, and then, you know, it's still pretty you know, it's pretty busy. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I'd go to a tournament here or there. You know, I would go to at least the draft pro tours. You know, I happen to, you know, to do well, and, you know, at the one in Kuala Lumpur 2008, you know, that was, I guess, the last actual draft pro tour they had. So, you know, I stopped again, but, you know, a couple of years ago they'd won Philly. I was like, sure, I'll go there. Mm-hmm. You know, I made top 16, and then, you know, they had, you know, Worlds later on in San Francisco, which is where my sister lives. So I was like, sure. I didn't do very well there, but this was like in Hawaii in the middle of February, I was like, sure, and I did well there, and then Barcelona, and then I kind of got roped back in. So I mean, I think that probably after some number of years, people are probably a little bit, tend to maybe not be able to, play and play to competitively and be such a big part of their life for, that many years in a row. So I don't know if it's necessarily making the Hall of Fame as much as it is just making the Hall of Fame generally means you've played a ton of competitive Magic, and maybe sometimes people, need breaks.
Sure.
On the other hand, you also have, like, I don't know, like the Levies and, the Ruels or who've like played in like some amazing, number of tournaments.
Do you have
I
any
don't know.
plans to attend any tournaments in the near future, John?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure I'm gonna go Dublin.
Okay. I mean, who would turn down Dublin? I
Yeah,
mean,
and I am part Irish,
of
so.
course, of course. I mean, and it sounds like it's interesting because it sounds like the tournaments you do decide to attend, it sounds like it's very like, since I'm here, it's very spur of the
Well, I
moment.
mean, I have played every, Pro Tour for the last 2 years. I mean, I ended up, because I made two top eights 2 years ago, I made platinum for last year. I didn't do quite last year, although I did at least make day two every day.
Can I ask what you call not and not doing so well?
I mean, there were three Pro Tours. I don't even remember my finishes were like. I mean, this last Pro Tour, I made day two, but did crappy there. The other two, I got cash of some sort, I think.
Okay.
I think maybe I was like top, I don't know, I don't even, you can look it up and find it. It was like 20 something and 30 something,
Okay.
or maybe there's a small chance I made top 60 in one of them, but I don't think so. I think it was like top 20 or top 24, whatever the next cutoff is, and like then when 30 something or whatever.
Yeah, I was just curious what you personally considered not
Yeah.
well.
Yeah, I mean, my win loss records were not that bad. I mean, they're about, I think, with the exception of the last Pro Tour, where I ended up going 50-50 and wherever it just was, I don't even know. But I mean, San Diego. I mean, I won like 2/3 of my matches in each of the other ones, but unfortunately, it was 2/3 in each rather than, winning a few more in one and a few less in the next.
With that said, though, John, do you think that there might come a time where Magic is no longer a part of your life anymore and where you can sort of look back and be like, those were great times, Magic did what it needed to do, and now I'm moving on? Or do you think that, Magic is always going to be a part of your life in some way?
I think, I mean, look, it's a good game. I like playing it. I mean, I have so many friends that, I grew up playing it with. I mean, I'm sure there'll be times that I'll be playing more or less Magic, but, as long as it's still, around as a game as big as it is now, I mean, I'm sure I'll sit down and play, here and again. It's not like, I feel like, you know what? It's not like I'm gonna say like, oh, like I quit playing it. It's just like I'll be playing it less. It's never gonna be a conscious decision of, oh, I'm done playing Magic. There's always the possibility that I'll wake up, realize it's been 2 years since I, cast a spell. But I mean, look, I wouldn't be shocked if, 10 years from now, I'm playing a Pro Tour, I'll be in my mid-40s, if there's still a Pro Tour,
Maybe you'll have some little Finkels and you can teach them how to play.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. I mean, I think that the, my sisters are gonna have kids before I do. So, and I guess they won't be Finkels, but
But still to have a cool uncle who's, regarded as one of the best players around, so
yeah, possibly cool. So yeah.
That's actually something I enjoy is I didn't realize this, but apparently there's a small community of what they call MTG dads, and it's crazy to think about the game being that old, and even at my local game store, I started playing around fourth edition, and it's weird to see people come into FNM with their children who were playing way back when and then passing it on to a new generation. And I love that the game has longevity like that and that it keeps going, and that's it's a crazy thing to think about, that and it doesn't show any signs of slowing down. So we very well could be teaching our kids how to play this, and that's a cool thing to think about, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, if I have, a child, I think there's a very good chance that, him or her will end up playing Magic.
Well,
Very good.
that's awesome to think about. So you've also mentioned throughout the show, John, that you like poker. I've noticed that a lot of pro players either have come from poker or eventually they end up gravitating towards poker. What is it about poker that you think attracts people like you to the game?
I mean, actually, I played very much poker for a number of years, but
Okay.
at that point, I, in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, I was playing a lot. It's, very similar skill set to Magic. There's a lot more money to potentially be won. Just another competitive intellectual endeavor. It's maybe not. So the difference between a game like Magic, a game like, like chess or a lot of other games, is that, Magic isn't quite so much about, it's not so much about memorizing everything and like thinking down every possible line of thought. It's more about kind of making statistically best plays and understanding from like board states kind of what's going to be important. So it's a game like poker where there's poker similar that there are a lot of very similar board states, to each other, where there's a lot of things you're generally correct to do, but sometimes you'll do something else. And again, it's a game of the percentages where, in the long run, if you're better, you're probably going to win more. But in any given game or match or tournament, you could have a much worse tournament than you should have, or a much better tournament than you should have. So, I think that it's those things, the that really led to Magic players being interested in poker. The fact that they had the skill set, they had the emotional understanding of like how to deal with variance, that it didn't really tap on a skill set they didn't need, something like chess. I mean, a lot of Magic players are also good chess players, especially competitive ones, but there's less overlap, I think, than people might think. And of course, the fact that this is a bunch of young kids who found that they could actually make real money playing poker. So I think all of those combined.
I think even on a lesser scale, even having a good poker face, it's like, when you see people, you're drawing your initial seven, and even though you have that amazing hand, the best response is to be like, I'll keep. You don't want to be like, oh, this is I'm gonna keep this hand. It's like you can't do that because then they're gonna know, like, oh shit, he's got a good hand. And at the same time, if you draw a bad hand, you can't be like, fuck, I'll mulligan. You just got to learn how to do little things like that too. Or if you're attacking into somebody, and let's say I don't know if you're familiar with Gore Clan Rampager, which is that red
Sure.
green,
Yeah.
you know,
No, I've
you
been
don't.
playing the last few sets, so I mean,
Okay.
I'm aware with all the new current
Yeah,
cards.
so let's say you're attacking somebody and you want to be able to slap the rampage around something and you don't want them to necessarily know you have that. You're not going to look at them being like, don't block, come on, don't block. You really got to play it cool so that you can throw a Gore Clan Rampager or that so when someone tries to target you, you can do a face shield and screw them over. You've really got to learn how to bluff your plays too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important. I think both Magic and poker people way over, way overestimate how important it is. I mean, obviously, you don't want to like, give away everything. But it's something in poker too. It's like sometimes it's like hard to tell if somebody's nervous because they have nothing or nervous because they have like a huge hand. So while it's not important, I think that the relative importance of it is probably somewhat overstated in people's minds.
Now, you've also been open about the fact that you work as part of a hedge fund in New York. What made you decide that you wanted to get into finance? Because a lot of people I know who've either played Magic, retired pro players, or things like that, they tend to go for jobs in the gaming industry. So what made you go the opposite route?
I mean, there are a lot of Magic players who've done pretty well as traders in New York, and I mean, what I'm doing is, most akin to trading. I mean, people, use the term finance, but and to them, like a banker and a trader are very similar, whereas in reality they're very far apart. They just happen to both be playing with other people's money, or sometimes their own money.
But you tend to make money, whereas bankers tend to lose it. So,
Well, no, I mean not on average.
okay.
I mean obviously most investment bankers make money, and the deals they're on do well. I mean, whatever. I mean, obviously there were like massive excesses dealt with the, in the financial crisis, and I think that the banks have way too large a percentage of GDP and way too much in the way of like implicit government protections.
Hey now, I'm a banker, John Finkel. Be nice.
Well, are you?
I work for quality control for a large banking firm, so I'm not technically a
Yeah.
banker, but I do. And it's funny is when I tell people I work for quality, I do quality control for a bank. They're like, "Huh? Where were you the last few years?" I'm
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, they were basically allowed to play a huge game of heads I win, tails you lose. I mean, whatever. I also think that there should be a transactions tax, you know, for stock trading, which would be awful for our fund. But I just think as a, in terms of policy, it would be a good policy. You know, I mean, that, you know, just whatever. That's a whole another line that has something to do with magic.
I'll have you back on for the finance show. It'll be.
But yeah, and you know, I mean, you know, I feel like magic players tend to be, you know, libertarians, often right libertarian, or you know, kind of progressive. I mean, I would describe myself as like a, you know, a socialist, you know, in the European style. So despite what I do for a living, but yeah, I mean, you know, I've been gambling for a living for most of my life and playing magic. Couple people that I knew from the blackjack team. Well, you know, I played blackjack on a team, you know, from like 2000 to like 2003 or so. You know, I'd started this hedge fund at the end of 2006. A partner of mine that I'd done a lot of gambling with, I mean, both from the team and since then, and I, you know, we knew them, we invested with them. My partner used to be an options trader. He had an idea of some strategies. You know, so we, you know, we kind of did it as like a joint venture. It went really well. You know, I mean, like our sub venture did even better than the fund as a whole. Though later on, the strategy ended up doing poorly. But you know, we so we decided to roll the hedge fund and start in this kind of joint venture just into one thing with equal partners. I mean, we're small for a hedge fund. You know, I mean, we have like, I don't know, 30 to 35 million in assets under management, which is like a rounding error to a lot of hedge funds. But, you know, we're also small. We, you know, don't have a ton of overhead. And, you know, I mean, we've, you know, managed to, you know, do reasonably well. So we, you know, so we can pay our bills, you know.
It certainly sounds like you've done something, you know, pretty incredible with your life and with your time in magic. And you've really been able to, you know, I had Darwin Castle on my show a couple seasons ago, and he had stressed how important it was to, you know, take everything you've done and think of it as an investment. And it sounds like you've really taken the time you've spent in magic and turned it into something great. And that's very admirable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like I almost have like a different way of thinking about it. Like, I don't sit around thinking about like when I'm doing things, you know, is this like an investment in like my future earnings potential, or is this, you know, I don't know. It's perhaps a more mercenary way than, you know, I want to deal with every, you know, moment, you know, with each moment of my life as it comes. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm sure that, you know, on some level, my internal calculus takes that, you know, into account. It's not saying like I don't want to, you know, just, you know, do things that I want to do in the moment and not care about the future. But, you know, again, like I'm not like, oh, well, my, you know, I played magic and it was like, you know, this investment, this next thing and this next thing, because really that was never why I played. You know, I mean, I played to make money. I played because it was fun, because that was what I wanted to do.
Right. But still, I think, you know, it is cool to look back on it, to think, you know, that, you know, it, not to sound like I'm diminishing what you've done, John, but to say that, you know, you started off as, just like you said, you started off as somebody who was playing a card game for fun, and look at you now. That's a pretty big journey.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you know, I do, you know, I saw my dad earlier today. I was down in Philadelphia, and, you know, he mentioned, which is something that, you know, I thought of a fair bit, is, you know, how different my life would have been without magic. You know, I mean, my career would have been probably totally different. You know, maybe I would have gone to a good school, but, you know, my friends would be totally different. My life would be totally different if it hadn't been for magic. So, I mean, you know, in terms of that, I'm very much aware of, you know, how magic directed my life. You know, but I've never really thought about it as like an investment in my future, if that makes sense.
Did your parents ever rib you about that when you were coming up of, you know, why don't you just quit this card game and get a real job or go to a real school? Did you ever get that?
I mean, I would have gone to real school if I'd gotten in, which would have required me doing my homework.
Which goes back to the lazy thing we talked about earlier.
You know, but, you know, I failed out of my, you know, my first year of Rutgers.
What?
You know, I actually entered as a sophomore because I was good at tests and I took every AP test.
Wow.
And I remember saying to my dad, you know, Dad, I think I can make a living playing cards. And he was like, you know, my dad's kind of a gamer himself. You know, he's not as my parents are, you know, particularly heavy handed in any way. You know, but he was like, no, that's crazy. I mean, he said, you know, the only time in your life I ever, you know, tried to make you do anything, I was dead wrong. You know, A time when I failed out of school, it's like, hey, I'll make a living playing cards. They were not, very enthusiastic, but not too long after that, I made my first top eight, in the fall of '97 at Chicago, and then early '98, I won New York. I made the U.S. national team. I made, I made the whatever to the I lost in the semis of Worlds. So pretty soon after, I was like, oh yeah, like I just made like 100 grand in a year playing Magic. So I mean, there was at least some real world evidence to back up my my belief.
That had to have felt really good, no?
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, the first top eight, at least for me, meant more than any of the other ones.
Were they there when you were inducted into the Hall of Fame?
My mom was.
Okay.
My mom came over, so that was nice. I think my sister also wanted to go to Japan.
Okay.
I think one of her friends was going to be there, like, I don't know, a week before, a week after, so she came out as well for some overlapping period.
Okay. That must have been a really great moment.
Yeah, no, it was it was very gratifying to be I don't think at that point people really fully realized how big and how important the Magic Hall of Fame kind of would be to the community, but it was still pretty awesome, to be. It was also, I guess, pretty young to be inducted into Hall of Fame, in anything, right? I was probably 27 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
I always like seeing that the fact that the parents are involved, and I know I think even Kibler thanked his mom and things like that, because when we're growing up and we're young, our parents don't get it. They might be giving you money for the cards. They don't know why you're wasting time with it. They think you can do better, and you could be focusing your time elsewhere. And it's always nice to see parents come around and realize that you can take something positive away from the game, and the game's done a lot of positive things for you, and I'm sure other people. And it's great to see that kind of that 180 turnaround where they get it and they realize that it wasn't, so bad, at all. That's a cool feeling.
Yeah, and I mean, we have our charity, Gamers Helping Gamers, and after the first year after we gave away after we announced our winners, we've actually decided for this year, but I don't think it's been published yet, so I won't talk about that. But one of the kids, Douglas Johnson, was I don't remember if it was him, because both him and his mother wrote us very nice thank you letters. It's like, I don't remember if it was him who said it, talk about his mom, or if it was his mom, but just like, how amazing slash ridiculous it was that, that this game that, she'd been, spending all this time on. I mean, I think she was a pretty supportive mom, but ended up, giving him a bunch of money for college. Just like how like crazy that was.
I didn't know you had a charity, John Finkel.
Yeah, we have a charity that's actually started by my friend Tim McKenna.
Okay.
The board, I mean, Chris McCool was on our board, Bob Maher, some other people are maybe slightly less famous Magic names, like Eric Berger. Eric Berger was actually on the team that ended up winning that last team Grand Prix in Providence.
Okay.
He also got married, I guess, just over a week ago. It was not this Friday, but the Friday before that. So congratulations, Eric, although you're probably
Yeah.
not gonna listen here. Matt Wang, who's, an old school Magic player, he's, been involved with Brian David Marshall's partners for years in game companies. He also won a team Grand Prix with actually with Steve OMS at the Two-Headed Giant one, I think up in Boston, like 2008. And of course, I think I already mentioned Tim McKenna, who
Yeah.
who was the founder of it.
And it's gamers helping
Was it?
gamers.
It is Gamers Helping Gamers. So
Okay.
yeah, if anybody, wants to give us money, or is thinking about next year, gamershelpinggamers.org is our URL.
Now, what
So
would you say is your charity's main objective, or what do you guys do?
I mean, we give scholarships to
Okay.
to Magic players. This will be our second this will be our second set of scholarships. So we're giving out this year, or I think we're giving out one this year. We gave out two last year. One of them was the other one last year was to a he was entering his senior year, Dylan Fay, and he'd he'd worked every every summer, but he actually got an internship with Senator Nelson from Florida. So this was, I think, I mean, he was obviously an excellent candidate. We only helped him out for 1 year because he was a junior and a senior, but he ended up getting accepted to Harvard Law School. So I guess that worked out okay. Although I mean, it's of course all 99% him, but maybe maybe we let him sleep a little easier at night. I mean, the idea is just to find Magic players who look, I mean, Magic players, I think, often are bright people. They're probably brighter than average. They probably also try a little bit less hard at school than average. Although this has definitely not been the case with a lot of our applicants. But I think that there are a lot of, bright people who maybe are really interested in magic, and there are always scholarships for people that are interested in, a million other things. You can find, probably like quilting scholarships,
You can get a scholarship for being
rowing.
tall.
Yeah, exactly. We thought, well, this is kind of our community. This is a group of people that we know are bright, capable people. So, we take need into account as well when, when giving out our scholarships. It's such as colleges going through the roof.
Do you read any of
So,
those letters and maybe see a bit of yourself in these kids, or?
yeah, I mean, you definitely read, some of these letters, and you obviously, or I guess essays, and you read, obviously you think a lot about, yourself, and kind of what it was like to be, young and finding this game. I mean, it's there's definitely a lot there. These are good kids. I mean, I'm saying kids, like, because I'm in here, but
Give them like the playful chuck across the jaw, little whippersnappers, you know?
yeah, something like that.
So you gained a lot of publicity a couple years ago in a very unusual way. You went on what you thought was a typical date with somebody, and come to find out that she was an intern at a website, and she proceeded to write all about your date and was very terrible to you, and said you were a bad date and you were all these things. And in your AMA on Reddit, you had said after the fact that you found it all to be a little bit creepy. What about the situation creeped you out?
It was just sort of thing where, you go on a date with somebody, and then, like, it's been a couple of weeks, you haven't really talked, you probably, begin to forget about each other's existence, and then all of a sudden, it's like, you get like 50 emails, in like 30 minutes about a article about, you and being on a date, and it seems like it's kind of like part of your private life that's being made public. And, I mean, and in its end, it wasn't, the article wasn't even really particularly disparaging of me. I mean, it was like, oh, like he was a huge nerd because he played Magic. Aren't you supposed to like disclose these things? Like if you're, divorced or have kids. And it was just, it's just weird. It was like, like I said, like the, I mean, if you, read through the initial article, it didn't even say that much necessarily bad or negative about me. I mean, I think she ended up coming out of it looking a little bit worse than I did. But it's just that, it's like, oh my God, like somebody, open up my, got, like open up my diary, not that I keep a diary, or read a bunch of my emails. You're like, oh my God, oh my God. And then you're like, oh, I guess they didn't actually read anything that bad. And people are, and a bunch of other people on the internet are out there saying positive things, which was nice.
You don't keep a diary?
No.
I just had this great image of you like sitting on your windowsill, like, "Dear diary, today I went to Yokohama and top eight at a Grand Prix."
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
were you surprised at how interested people were in this? Because the story really did take off, and it really—I was even seeing it on like mainstream, like CBS, Fox, like big name people were covering this, and they were you surprised that people were that interested in your personal life and the situation?
I think, it just kind of struck a chord with a lot of people, just because there's that idea of, the whole like nerd, it's like a lot of people kind of grow up feeling like nerds for a lot more than, really are, for, I mean, whatever that word means, and it's kind of like an adult version of like, oh, look, nerds, and people are like, okay, like, aren't we all kind of past that? But, it probably spoke to a lot of people who, I had felt similarly growing up, and I mean, I'm sure that, again, if that happened to, 18-year-old or 19-year-old John instead of whatever 32-year-old John, it would have been, you know, I probably would have felt a lot differently about it.
And overwhelmingly, the support was very much in your favor. Were you surprised about that too?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, no one was gonna. I mean, what were people gonna say? Like, oh, this guy. I mean, again, there was certainly nothing about me, you know, being a jerk or anything like that. You know, an asshole. So it's not like where they could be like, oh, this guy, you know, kind of sounds like an asshole. I mean, what worst they say is, okay, yeah, you don't want to go with a nerd, which, you know, a couple people said, you know, which is fine. I mean, but you know, I was, you know, somewhat gratified by the outpouring of support.
I think the reason, though, that why people were so overwhelmingly supportive, John, is because I feel like in the last couple of years there's been sort of a reclamation of the geek stigma and the nerd stigma, and it's become something that people were, you know, ashamed of, and they were believing all the stereotypes, just sort of saying, I am this, there's nothing wrong with it, I'm awesome, and they're sort of, you know, stepping on those stereotypes. You know, I'm sure you've heard it, where, you know, even when people were talking about GP Vegas, they were like, oh, 4,000 fat, sweaty nerds in a room, and it's like, no, like, you know, you can have a hobby that you love and be passionate about, and it doesn't mean you don't shower, and it doesn't mean you don't have a job, and it doesn't mean, you know, you're not driven or you lack, you know, goals or whatever. And it just seems like in the last few years people are really taking that word back, and maybe it, like you said, there's a history of it being used as an insult, where it's nerd and geek and dork, and people are going, yeah, I'm a nerd and I'm awesome and it's cool, and it's become cool to be different like that. And I think that's where it struck a chord, where, you know, here was somebody who was using those things and trying to spin it in a negative light, and people were going, that actually makes them a catch. Like, I know quite a few women were like, I'd date them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know that I only ever used the word nerd with, you know, positive connotations. Mm-hmm. I do have to say that, you know, like, a lot of times, you know, magic players, you'll see, it will be the ones that will, you know, like, oh, I'm cool as other people, you know, be the person who's like, oh, haha, you know, 4,000 fat, sweaty nerds in a room. And, you know, I don't know. I feel like, you know, you really shouldn't do that. I mean, you know, it's kind of your community. Like, let's not be the ones who are, you know, propagating these sorts of thoughts ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, especially not in like a public venue. So, I agree that, you know, there's certainly, you know, a lot less of kind of the, you know, the negative, you know, connotations and feelings about quote unquote nerds than there were, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What would you say that you took away from that experience, you know, as a whole, aside from, you know, a couple people asking you out and things like that?
I mean, you know, it's like kind of a funny, interesting story. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was, like I said, it was nice, you know, kind of the outpouring of support.
One of my followers wanted me to let you know that your nose is hot. I hope you're okay with that.
My nose is
your
hot.
Your nose. That's good.
You know, I got a nose job. I got a rhinoplasty. No, it's true. I was breaking up a fight in college. I got punched in the face, and I got my nose broken. And so, you know, they had to set it so it would, you know, so that, it, you know, it would heal properly. And, you know, it's a rhinoplasty, which is the, you know. Now, the difference between this and a regular nose job, you know, is that, you know, with the regular nose job, they break the nose first and then shape it into the proper shape. Whereas in my case, you know, it was broken by, you know, somebody else, and they made sure that it was, you know, straight so I could breathe. I guess it's probably pretty similar to what it was before, but thank you to unknown followers. Well.
That would be my friend Sonia B. She's one of my followers. She's a big fan of your nose. So.
All right. Well, thank you, Sonia.
But it's interesting because, I've had a couple of people on my show, and they seem to feel like, you know, relationships go a lot better when you're dating somebody who plays Magic, whether or not they started off playing Magic when they met you, or, you know, if they're eventually sort of indoctrinated into the game. Is that something you think you might agree with, or can you have a relationship with somebody who has no interest in it?
I mean, none of the, you know, girls I've dated, you know, or the ones that they date seriously have been Magic players. Mm-hmm. I could see it going either way. You know, that if someone got interested in it, that would be fine. I mean, probably every girl that I've dated seriously have at least taught something of like the basics, you know, played some, you know, Portal. Well, Portal's what they used to call, like,
I remember Portal.
You know, with them. You know, but I mean, I don't think it's, you know, necessarily that important. You know, it's, I mean, maybe it's kind of nice or interesting. You know, it's also like a bit rough, right? It's like there's this game that you've been playing for, you know, 20 years that, you know, you've like years of like, you know, expertise at, right? And somebody's trying to play from the beginning, you know, play with you and your friends. You know, I can see being, you know, frustrating for them as well. I mean, like I say, I think it would be, you know, nice. I mean, if I had a choice between, you know, if I'm dating a girl, she's gonna play Magic or not, I would choose yes. But I don't think it's particularly, I don't think it's necessary by any, you know, by any means.
As long as you don't hold it against her, like, and you're teaching her how to play, and it's like, you know, oh my God, she plays blue, you know, I can't ever see you again.
Just, no, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, blue would actually be a plus.
Oh.
But yeah. You're not gonna be like, oh look, I mean, you know, you're not good at Magic, you know. Let's, I mean, you know, you know, I can't go out to you, you know.
So what color would a girl have to play for you to not be interested in her? Black, red?
I guess green would be the color. Although, you know, they've kind of been making green better for like the last, you know, 5 or 10 years or whatever.
Wow, you probably cut out a lot of candidates. All these girls staring at their threat tests.
Green and white were, you know, well, threat test, because I think it's pretty much a blue card.
Oh, yeah, you could say that.
I mean, you know, my understanding is it was the best blue card in Standard for a few years, you know, or however long it was legal for.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like, you know, it used to be like the bad players would play green-white decks, you know, earn them, get them decks.
Right.
You know, I mean, I played a fair bit of white, like blue-white decks, but, you know.
And then you became the Shadow Mage Infiltrator.
Yes, yeah. Well. Yeah, I mean, that color, you know, the flavor-wise had to be blue and black, even though it was a combination I haven't really played a ton. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
So if anyone was interested in, you know, getting a hold of you or finding out more about you or just keeping up with you and what you're up to, how can people reach you? Are you on Twitter, Facebook, anything like that?
You know, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. But as a rule, I don't really accept friend requests from people that I don't know in person on Facebook. I apologize. You know, I get tons of friend requests. You know, I reject, you know, if almost all of them or most of them, I just... You know, until my, you know, most of them I just ignore until, like, I think it's like 1,000 friends that, like, it won't let you get any more. So every once in a while I'll go through and, like, say not now to, like, you know, a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter. I mean, you'll probably get, you know, more in terms of, like, progressive ideology than Magic. But, you know, here and there you'll get some Magic.
Okay. And if they wanted to keep up with your charity, can they find that online too?
Yeah. So, you know, gamershelpinggamers.org. We also have a Twitter account, although we don't do a ton with it, which I think is just at Gamers Helping Gamers.
Okay.
I can't even confirm that that's the – it's at, you know, it's actually at @GHG_magic, although if you just search for Gamers Helping Gamers, you'll find it.
Okay.
But, you know, the website's the best place to go. You know, we just finished our process for giving out scholarship, you know, for grant scholarship this year.
Great.
You know, like I say, anybody out there who wants to, you know, give us money, you know, you can stop by there and do so.
Great. Well, I have to say, John, of the past 49 shows that I've done, this has easily been the high point. So thank you so much for agreeing to do this. And I really, really appreciate this. And I'm sure my listeners will enjoy getting to see a different side of you on my show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on the show. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Awesome. And if anyone else is listening and you've enjoyed anything you've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find me on legitmtg.com, first and foremost. You can also find me on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Feel free to leave me a review and some stars. If you have any personal feedback for me, you can always find me on Twitter at @OriginalOestrus. That's OriginalOestrus. Or if you'd like to reach me a bit more directly, you can always email me at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys so much for listening and for hanging out with me for the last 49 shows, and I look forward to seeing you guys for the next 49. Take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.